You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
So Venerable Children's in Australia, and then she's headed to Indonesia. So we'll be doing the teachings for her for a few weeks, and we're going to spend some time with two of the verses that she taught on last week tonight. And so we'll start with our motivation. And so I'd like us first to listen to the verse 13 from the Precious Garland, the text we're studying. Such a person with a body entwined by the savage snakes of negative mental states wanders for a very long time in the terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence. Those trees are limitless beings. So in our Lam Rim, we have the recognition that to stay wandering in cyclic existence, we could end up in situations that are quite miserable, really. And so we think about our precious human life and our death and these various realms we might end up in order to spur ourselves on. So I thought for our motivation tonight, we'd think about the mindfulness of death. And this is from Lama Tsongkhapa. And so he says that those who have not practiced the path at all, so we know people that haven't practiced at all, the fear of death manifests itself as a worry that they'll be separate from their relatives. I'm sure we've all experienced that. And this can be a type of fear, I would say panic fear, and it's caused by their strong attachment. So do not develop that here. So what should you develop? Certainly nothing of your body, which you appropriated through karma and affliction, shall survive death. And this may frighten you, yet for the time being, you cannot stop it. However, you should fear death, and I would say a wisdom fear, if you have not secured your welfare in future lives by putting an end to the causes of the miserable realms and establishing the causes of high status or high rebirth and certain or highest goodness. The topics of our text that we're studying. If you consider your fear about this, it's within your power not to be frightened at the moment of death, because there are things you can do to secure your future welfare. But if you don't act on those things, you could be tormented by regret at the time of death. You might fear not being liberated from cyclic existence, or falling into a lower realm. So now the Buddha in the garland, in the Jataka tales, he said, though you hold fast, you cannot stay. What benefit is there in being frightened and scared of what cannot be changed? Thus, when you analyze the nature of the world, humans are regretful at death because they have created harmful actions and have not brought forth virtuous actions. They worry about sufferings to come in the future lives, and the fear of dying clouds their minds. However, I do not know of anything I have done that would make me regretful, and I have made myself accustomed to virtuous actions. Why should anyone who abides in the teaching fear death? So we use this to spurn ourselves on, to give ourselves energy, this energy of a wisdom fear, really. And what we do then is we turn to refuge and karma as things to practice. So may we use our time tonight to look into this topic, and may we develop ourselves, our capacity fully, and be able to help others with the same path, everyone we meet. don't really find it morbid to think about death, since we have it in the context of our teachings. This last week, I thought for a while I might die. I was on an airplane, and I was very happy to be a Buddhist. I just did what Venerable has taught us to do and made my mind very peaceful, and here I am. So, in that, appreciating this precious opportunity that's so rare, that we have a lot, you know, our lives are very special, not because we're so special, but what we can do with them. But this won't last forever, and so that's why we contemplate death, to give us that, spurn us on, and also realizing our human potential, our precious human life. So we don't really want to continue with the same old craziness. And in the concern that we have for this, then what do? We turn to some guides to help us to go in a positive direction, and this is what refuge is about. We turn to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha for guidance and for refuge. And what's the first teaching is the teaching on karma, and that is that our actions have an ethical dimension. So that's where we are in the Lam Rim, in this section of the book of Precious Garland. And tonight, my more specific motivation for the teachings tonight and the next few weeks are, I was, a few weeks back, Venerable asked us about the 10 non-virtues, the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action. And she asked us to name them off and everything, and we kind of faltered. And I was thinking, this is not something to falter in. When I first started going to Buddhist centers in Seattle, I was going to two centers where Venerable Children taught in the Sakya Monastery. Right off the bat, these teachings were introduced at both places and were handed out on sheets at the Sakya Monastery, and Venerable was telling us, you know, having us memorize these. And so I was getting it from both ears, right, two places. And why were they doing that? And that's what I want to kind of address here, is like, why should we know these? We need to know these because we need to, we all want happiness, and we need to create the causes for it. And the causes are virtue. And we all don't want to suffer and end up in lower realms, or even if we can't quite put our minds, wrap our minds around the lower realms, we don't want to end up in any kind of suffering. So we need to create the causes not to have that, which are abandoning these non-virtuous activities. So because I was getting it in both ears, I just made it a practice. I think it was for at least a year, it might have been a year and a half, every night I would review. I was getting really introduced much more formally to the Buddhist worldview, and I was reviewing these 10 destructive actions and the 10 wholesome or constructive actions each evening. And, you know, a whole level of confusion lifted from my mind that I had carried with me, I think, all of my life. I don't think I was aware of it as a, maybe when I was 8 or younger, but I'm sure by the time I was 10, I was starting to be aware of this. And that just kind of dissipated without me even trying. So I've always had an affinity for this topic, I guess. And I think it's quite important. And as Venerable said, and I found this in both Lama Tsongkhapa and Geshe Sopa's texts on this, it's actually at this point that our Dharma practice really begins. So what are they saying there? And just think about this. You know, if we observe the laws of karma, if we actually really believe in it, we really practice then. And it's obvious, anyone who watches their own life, that I would say this for myself anyway, my conviction in this isn't strong enough, because if it was, my life would be different. And so, you know, it's really a call to practice, because cause and effect permeates everything that we do. It permeates our daily lives. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, knowing the 10 paths of non-virtuous actions and their effects restrain yourself from even being motivated to commit them. Then practice the paths of action of the 10 virtues, which your body, speech, and mind are not at all mixed with the paths of the non-virtuous action. This practice is indispensable as the basis for all three vehicles, as well as for the accomplishment of the two aims of beings. And that's what our text is about, this, I always want to say definite goodness, but it's a, I think she's using upper rebirth and highest goodness as the translations now. So basically having a higher rebirth and liberation and full awakening. Hence the conqueror, the Buddha, repeatedly praised it from many perspectives. And then he goes on to quote a sutra. What I have called virtues are the taproots of the perfections of all deities and humans. They are the taproots of the enlightenment of the Shravakas and the Praetabhuka Buddhas. They are the taproots of the unexcelled perfect enlightenment. And what are these taproots? They are the 10 virtuous actions. So that brings us up to our the next verse in the book. Tonight we're going to talk mostly, kind of introduce the topics in karma that relate to these 10 pathways of action, and then we'll maybe go in a little bit to the body, and then in the next weeks the actions of speech and mind. And so the next verse from Precious Garland is verse 14. Due to killing, one is born with a short lifespan. Due to violence, one encounters much torment. Due to stealing, one becomes impoverished. Due to adultery, one has enemies. So, now I don't know what to call it. I wouldn't say it's a commercial break. Maybe it's a taking Venerable Sompton's teaching modes. Okay, so we're going to memorize the 10 non-virtues first of body. Killing, can you see that? Killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Every week we're going to do this. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. You want to learn them in this order. Three of the body. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Four of the speech. Lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk. Lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk. Lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk.
Much worse than lions, tigers, and bears.
Okay. Coveting, three of mind. Coveting, malicious intent, and wrong view. Okay, coveting, malicious intent, and wrong view. That's what I learned from you. Okay, and then we also want to remember the 10 virtuous actions. And I think these might be in my own words, but whatever, you have to deal with it. So these are the three of the body. Protect life, protect others' property, use your sexuality wisely and kindly. Protect life, protect others' property, use your sexuality wisely and kindly. That's three of the body. So either non-harm, you know, non-killing, non, or in the positive frame, it's this way. And then four of speech, speak the truth, use words that promote harmony, use words that are kind and gentle, and speak to a purpose. Speak the truth, use words that promote harmony, use words that are kind and gentle, and speak to a purpose. So I just haven't memorized, although I guess on this one I changed my words, this last one. So now the four of speech and the three of mind. Rejoice in others' good fortune and be generous. Cultivate the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And develop your conviction in rebirth, Buddha nature, and karma. Okay, so rejoice in others' good fortune and be generous. Cultivate the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, and develop your conviction in rebirth, Buddha nature, and karma. Okay, that's our little teacher plug. Okay, we did it. Okay. So in the Pali tradition, they also have 10 wholesome actions. So I thought I'd just list those because it's interesting to see how these things are in the different traditions. In their tradition, the 10 wholesome actions are generosity, ethical discipline, meditation, humility and reverence, offering service, dedicating merit, rejoicing at virtue, listening to Dharma teachings, teaching the Dharma, and straightening out our views, or I think Venerable might say developing correct views. So kind of introducing this topic, which as you'll see as we get in this, it could get kind of cut and dry, and I don't think that gives the topic the right context. So I want to, tonight's mostly introduction because of that. So the first thing to kind of think about is what we bring to the table growing up in the culture. If many of us have had a lot of conditioning both from our culture and from the Judeo-Christian idea of retribution. And so even though we come to these teachings maybe not knowing we have that view, we might find sometimes that we're hearing it through that kind of filter. And that might make us confused, especially because we're actually not hearing what the Buddha taught. So we want to try to be aware of when things don't kind of land right for us, to try to find out what's going on there. For instance, I have been taught very directly by Venerable Children that there is no concept in Buddhism of reward and punishment. It's just not there. The karma isn't about reward and punishment. It's not somebody governing the universe who's, you know, deciding who gets reward and who gets punished. That's not the Buddhist worldview. But after years of doing our purification practices, one winter retreat, I realized that a part of my mind was thinking of this practice as punishment. And many of us here have had this experience of just subtly finding ways, and as you'll see, we make a big distinction between guilt and regret in the practice of purification for the same reason. So in the Buddhist worldview, there's no one running the universe, pulling the strings and sending you here or there. The belief is that our life is completely created by the force of our own mind. So we create a cause, and it naturally brings a result that corresponds to that causal energy. So an analogy could be like planting flowers in the spring. When the flowers go, they're the results of the seeds you planted, but they're not the punishment of the seeds, they're not the reward of the seeds, they're just the results of the seeds. And so this kind of understanding is important, because what we're going to do here is we're going to look at the different kind of actions that we do and the kind of results they bring, and we want to make sure that we're looking at it through a Buddhist worldview, not thinking, oh, somebody did some horrible thing and they're going to get punished because they're a bad person. That's not in the Buddhist worldview. It is true that our actions can be harmful, but it doesn't mean that we're bad people. It means we make a clear distinction between the action and the person who does the action. And we hold this within the recognition that all sentient beings, people included, have this Buddha potential, but their minds are overwhelmed by afflictions, and so they act in harmful ways. We do. We know this. So this thinking of, you know, yourself or anyone else as evil or bad or sinful, that's not really part of Buddhism. So this is a big thing to recognize. And also, when someone, we would verse it more, say it more like what their actions are mistaken. You know, we've made mistakes. This is what the words we use when we do our purification. So it doesn't mean that what's going to result from that is a punishment. It's just that we've planted a seed and now we're going to get a result from that. A certain kind of seed is going to bring a certain kind of result. So really, you might say in conclusion of thinking of karma as some kind of retribution, that has where you deserve suffering, that doesn't exist in Buddhism. That idea is not there. More what's there is the meditation that we first do in our Lam Rim. The mind is the source of happiness and pain. The source of our experiences is our own consciousness. And it's in the sense that our if I experience happiness, it's coming from my own actions. And these actions were motivated by my own mind, maybe in the previous lives. And same thing with pain. If pain comes our way, it's not solely from our own actions, but the source, if you really go down to it, comes down to our motivation, which is something in our consciousness. So that means there's no one really else to blame or accuse. We can't blame or praise God, because in Buddhism we don't believe that there's a God that's directing the show here in this way. So, you know, so one way that we might say this is there are causes and conditions for our suffering, and we are the principal cause, but there's all kinds of conditions. So we speak of five kinds of causality in the Pali Canon, in the commentaries: a physical, a biological, kind of mind processes type, karmic causality, and dharmic or dhammic causality. So karmic causality here is that there's an ethical dimension to our actions. So these things that are happening, to say it was their karma, His Holiness says that means, people say that when they don't know, you know, I don't know, it was their karma, you know, I think he's right there. So there's an interaction of different types of causality. And it's important to recognize that the Buddha didn't invent causality. It's a natural functioning of the way things exist. He just described it. And so he didn't invent wholesome or positive or negative actions either. Those weren't invented by the Buddha. He didn't say, this is a negative action because I say so. He didn't say that. He just described things the way a doctor might describe something. So you're sick because you have this virus. It's like that. The doctor doesn't create the virus. He doesn't create the link between the virus and the illness. He's just describing it. And so we want to understand that description because we want to avoid that virus and the sickness that it gives us. So that's more the way it goes here. So in this sense, there's no value judgment. The Buddha isn't attaching any kind of value judgments to the notions of causality. And this is quite important to think about. We have to sift through our own experience and weed out these kind of incorrect thoughts that we have about this when we look at our experience. So this part of the Lam Rim teachings on karma has three main topics, and they are the general aspects of karma, the specific aspects of karma, and then, having considered cause and effect, how to engage in positive actions and avoid destructive ones. So it's kind of like what to adopt and what to abandon. And that we do that in Buddhism, I would say, based on seeing the advantages and disadvantages of things. It's quite important. It makes you want to do this quite easily if you can see the advantages and disadvantages of things. You just adopt things naturally because it's for your own interest. It's a natural way to go, and that's how the Buddha taught. But the first thing, I think, that will help us in this is to talk about these general aspects of karma. And I'll just list them first real quickly so that everybody knows what we're reviewing here. Karma is definite. The results of an action increase, or karma is expandable. If an action is not done, one will not meet with its results. Or you could say, if the cause hasn't been created, the result won't be experienced. And actions don't go to waste without yielding a result. Or you could say also that karmic latencies don't get lost, we'll experience the results. So we're going to just spend a little bit of time with that so we can understand how these 10 pathways of actions work better. So what we're saying here in karma is definite. What is definite about it? If you create that all happiness comes from constructive, virtuous, wholesome actions, and all painful experiences come from destructive, non-virtuous, unwholesome actions, it's never the case that something that you would experience pain, for example, as a result of a constructive action. That's not the case. There's a very definite relationship between a wholesome action and happiness, and unwholesome action and suffering. And so this is really something for us to think about, because it's not where we go. When we are happy, we don't just think that it's from our wholesome actions in the past. It's probably from that great ice cream we had at lunch with the great raspberries and whatever. We think it's in the ice cream. Oh, it's in the raspberries, right. You know, it's the mix. Yeah. So, you know, that's where our mind goes, right? So we have to really think about this. So there is a principal cause for our happiness, which is our virtuous actions, and then there are cooperative conditions. But the principal cause is the karmic one. And it's the same thing with painful things. So someone might be screaming and yelling at you, whatever, but they're only the cooperative condition. They are not the cause of your misery in that moment. You could actually have compassion in that moment. There's many things you could feel in that moment. The reason you're having misery in that moment is because somewhere in your past lives, you've created a cause for that. And with this understanding, this is actually very empowering, because we see that we're kind of in the driver's seat. We are in the driver's seat here. If we understand this, it gets the feeling that we can do something about our situation. We don't have to look outside of ourselves. And no matter, think about whatever situation you would be in. Like today I was reading about these two brothers that were in prison for 30 years who were just let out, found DNA evidence that they didn't do this murder. Wow. And they were both somewhat low IQs. There was no physical evidence and da 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 da. You know, just you put yourself in these situations that people are in, and like, how would you deal with that? You know? And so how do you deal with it? If you understand these teachings right here, that the mind is the source of happiness and pain, based on these teachings that the Buddha is giving us on karma, you don't have to rot in jail, you know. You can make your life meaningful, and we see that in our interactions with the inmates. Your life isn't over. It's very constricted, and it's not so safe. Actually, they're giving these guys $50,000 a year for every year they were incarcerated, up to $750,000, which is good, because they gave them $45 when they got out after 30 years. So whatever, we need to practice. We need to empower ourselves with this, realizing that we can create wholesome, positive causes, we can abandon unwholesome, harmful things, and we can purify our harmful actions. And that gives us a sense of empowering ourselves, this kind of understanding. And how did the Buddha know this? It's because of his clairvoyant powers. And if you read in the Pali Canon about when he was, his description of his awakening, it's all right there. He was able to see what kind of causes. He worked backwards. He saw the effects, and he was able to see backwards into what were the causes. So that's, and he then labeled those causes destructive if they caused suffering. He worked it backwards. Okay. So that's the first one. The second one is that results of an action increase. Our karma is expandable. And so this is important for our day-to-day life. It helps us to really look at the little things we do, like this little white lie. Doesn't matter. One little extra zero on my income tax form. Just a small little thing with an ink pen. Pretty small. doesn't matter. That's where I think of this for some reason. I think, wow, that could have big consequences. And it's just a small little ink mark. Anyway, but, you know, small things that we do, small actions that we don't think will hurt anything. Karma, the teachings on karma don't say that. You know, when I was a kid, it was kind of like, if you don't get caught, it's all right. No. Small little things, if we understand karma, it leaves maybe a small imprint, but that imprint can get nourished and it can increase, just like a little seed can give you a big oak tree. And so there can be, it expands and can bring many results. Or sometimes maybe there's something constructive that we want to do that only takes a few minutes and we don't feel like we're very good at it, you know. Like, oh, I'll sit and meditate here for 5 minutes, but I'm such a lousy meditator, so why bother, you know, why bother? But again, 5 minutes is small, right? But those things add up. I remember when I learned a practice, it was so funny, I learned this green Tara practice. It was like very short. It was a daily practice, and it was like 3 short paragraphs. And I used to do that every day, and I felt very good about myself for doing this. And I told somebody I knew at the Sakya Monastery, he thought, oh, you're doing that long sadhana that's like 30 pages every day? And I said, no, I'm just doing this little thing. And he just poo-pooed it. But you know what? That practice I did that time had a huge impact on my practice, what I was doing. It was just a small little thing, but I found when I thought about the time I spent doing that, it was quite beautiful and uplifting, and it led me in a really good direction. So that's my experience on that one for that point. So what this, the bottom line here is we want to refrain from even small, destructive, unwholesome actions, and we want to put our energy even into small, constructive actions. And the person who exemplifies that the best around here is our abbess. She does the smallest little things. I've always noticed that about her. You know, and that's why we walk clockwise around our images here. You know, when we do certain things here, we go clockwise because we're, you know, if we know what we're doing, we're doing just a little bit of merit in that moment. Just a small little thing. But, you know, remember that story about the bug or that went around 3 times on a piece of shit around some stupa and became, who knows what, an arhat or something? I can't remember. Small, whatever. Okay, so that's because of the expanding nature of an action. And then the third one is, if an action is not done, one will not meet with its results. Basically, if you haven't created the cause, you're not going to get the result. So, you know, think about it in terms of gardening. If you don't plant seeds, you don't get flowers, right? So one example that is always, I think, good for us to hear about, that the karmic cause of being wealthy is being generous. Because it's so counterintuitive. If I give away this, I'm not going to have anything, is how the mind goes. And everything that we learn in Buddhism is, you know, if you give what you can give, you know, offer what you have to offer with delight, that's generosity. That's creating the cause of wealth. But the stingy mind, the miserly mind, is like, no, can't do that. So some people might make prayers to be wealthy, but actually Venerable said that's like talking to outer space because it doesn't have anything to do with the cause. So in terms of our practice then, like, you know, if we want to generate realizations and insights, too, we have to create the cause. They're just not going to come by saying, Buddha, send me some realizations, you know. That's not going to work. So here's Venerable Chodron telling us that, and I think she lives this quite well, if we want realizations, we have to put some energy into creating the cause for it. I think we want to try to be as consistent as we can in creating the causes for understanding, progress, and improvement in our mind. But we shouldn't get impatient for the results to come. If the causes are created, the results will come. When you plant seeds in the ground and you add water and fertilizer and there's ample sunshine and you know the seeds are going to grow, you don't have to go over them, stand over them and say, come on, grow, why aren't you growing? I planted you a whole week ago, where are you? You don't go and dig them up all the time. You know, if the causes are there, the flowers are going to come around. And so it's the same with our practice. So here we want to create the causes. In this particular teaching, we want to try to avoid unwholesome actions. Oh, yeah. So when we're doing this, you know, generating our virtue and our motivations and this and that, doing, you know, the various practices that we do, we have to not let impatience get in the way. You know, we're always wanting results. It's a big problem, wanting to be a Buddha tomorrow or something. So it's this learning how to just be content to create causes, big teaching. And that's based on knowing that these small things we do matter, because they, yeah. Okay, and the fourth one is if we don't, actions don't go to waste without yielding a result. Or another way to say that is the karmic latencies don't get lost. We will experience the results. So these different actions that we do leave imprints on our mind. And these imprints don't ripen immediately, so the results don't come immediately. They may take lifetimes to come, but they will definitely come unless, we'll get to that. So if you think about it, that there's a lot of things that we do in our life that take years to come to fruition, and we do them because we know results will come. For example, some people make investments, and then 30 years later, they collect all the interest on those investments, right? Compounded interest. So that's not so certain, though, on the material level, because, you know, things could fall apart and you could lose your money. But in terms of karma, it's never uncertain. When you created these actions and these imprints are laid down, they don't dissipate. They don't go to waste. They eventually bring a fruition. Unless, we'll get to that. Because one of the things to understand is that karma isn't something that's cast in stone. It's not cast in concrete. There's flexibility. There's a lot of flexibility in karma. So one example would be, say you were to steal something, and you know that will bring an unwholesome or a suffering result in the future unless you purify, which is why that's a part of our practice every day. So it's similar, like if you were to plant a seed, it would bear fruit unless you take away the cooperative conditions, if it doesn't have water or fertilizer or heat, or if you burn the seed, if you take it out of the ground. So this is the same way with our purification. You're interfering with the karmic imprints on your mind stream. And this is what we do when we do, say, the 35 Buddha practice. So it's like taking away the water, taking away the fertilizer. And what happens then these imprints can't ripen so well, or they might ripen later, or they won't ripen as strongly, or they won't last as long. So we're interfering with this ripening process of these karmic imprints. And the more we purify, and especially the more we begin to understand emptiness, then we can actually, like you might say, burn these karmic seeds so that they can't bear fruit. And eventually we can actually uproot them or pull them out and completely eliminate them. And this is the real value of purification. It stops these karmic imprints from ripening, and thus we end our suffering, our dukkha. And these are the, you know. So here's Lama Tsongkhapa speaking about this. He says, the statement in both sutra and text on discipline, or the Vinaya, that, and the quote is, that karma does not perish even in 100 eons, is made with regard to the karma for which you have not cultivated a remedy with the four powers, what we know as the four opponent powers. However, if you purify yourself with a remedy, having these four opponent powers, essentially, it's said that you will even remove karma that you are bound to experience. So, you know, like I'm thinking there might be talking about the ones that, I don't know, send you immediately to a hell realm, maybe. I don't know, I heard you go for a second and then you pop right out. Anyway. And then another, so you can, basically you're getting rid, you're eliminating the unfavorable factors. And then, so not only is it true that our unwholesome karmic imprints can be interfered with, but our wholesome ones, our constructive imprints, can be interfered with too. So we might do something with a lot of strong intention to be very kind and be constructive, and we've planted these these imprints are now in our mind stream, and we may even dedicate them, which is also important for karmic to fortify these things, to make dedications. But if we then regret, say, that wholesome action, it's like you've taken away the fertilizer and the water. You know, you've changed the cooperative conditions around that seed so they can't ripen. Another thing that can do that is anger and wrong views. So Venerable Chodron said that when we generate very obstinate wrong views, we're interfering with the ripening of our positive karma. And this is why it's important not only to put effort into acting constructively and to dedicate it so it goes in the direction that we want. That's what we're doing with our dedications. We're steering our actions, our karma. But also to avoid anger and wrong views. These negative attitudes run counter to the effort we've been putting in. And so I always hear her say about anger is like, you know, one way that she works with her mind around anger is just like, I've worked so hard to create this virtue. They're not there, you know, because you're angry at the person who kind of works. They're not worth it. Why get angry at this person? They're not worth it. I'm destroying my virtue, you know. And when you're angry, that argument works pretty well, I think. You know, like, you're mad at them. They're not worth it. I'm not going to destroy my virtue. Hey, anything to control the crazy mind. Okay, so then Baba Vavika wrote this thing that I thought was well put on this. Wrong views and malice weaken virtuous karma. Remedies such as purification, restraint, and confession weaken bad karma. Whenever any of these attitudes are present, they reduce the potency of the seeds deposited by the virtuous and non-virtuous karma. Even though the combination of conditions for the karma to take effect are already in place. So that's kind of interesting, really. So it's like something is ready to take place, but it hasn't taken place yet. Once it's taken place, you can't withdraw it, you know. You've lost a leg, it's not going to come back. But what leads up to that moment where something catastrophic might happen can get interfered with, is what he's saying there. So where would an effect come from and what would it be like? Because there is no combination of conditions for maintaining the potency of the seeds deposited by karma, the time for being maintained has changed. And then he explains this. Because of this, there's a thorough eradication of the karma. So he gives some examples. One is, for example, by upholding the sublime teaching, you experience in this life the effects of an unwholesome action whose consequence you were certain to experience. Well, that doesn't sound so good, but what he's actually saying there is that a lot of times these things could ripen and the next example is it. Furthermore, with this remedy, the karma for a rebirth in the miserable realms transforms into a mere headache. That's what he's saying. Something that was going to propel you, you did a complete karma, it was going to propel you to a bad rebirth some point because its karma is definite, right? But you apply these remedies and you might just end up with a headache in this life, you know. That's why you need sunglasses. So that's awesome, you know. This is why, you know, we can't figure this out ourselves. The Buddha had to teach this because the details of this are extremely hidden phenomena. Okay, so then there's another point that I think is quite important for these 10 pathways of action, because as we get to them, you'll see it's kind of like, it's kind of rote, and you get the feeling like everything is so linear. But that's why I wanted to do this presentation, because it's not linear. Karma isn't linear. It's not like you do this and you get this, or you do that and you get that. It's not like that. There's a lot of flexibility, so things aren't fated or predetermined. And I think some people don't quite understand that all the time. So for a seed to ripen, there has to be the principal cause, which is the seed and all these cooperative conditions. And within that, I think we've made quite clear there's a lot of flexibility. So a lot of things could happen. Like say, for example, you planted a seed and you provide all this water and fertilizer and sunshine, it could grow huge. But if you use some other kind of fertilizer, it might grow in one way. Another kind of fertilizer, it might grow in another way. You see how the cooperative conditions are affecting things. Or it might grow a little bit and then fizzle out. You know, all these things happen when you're gardening, and you're always trying to figure out, what are the conditions here? My carrots need this. So there's all this flexibility. So in this sense, you might say that there's this potency in a seed, but you can't predict how big the apples are going to be. Although it does help, I guess, to do some pruning. So that's part of the conditions, right? So those are the cooperative conditions. So we have these karmic seeds in our mind stream, and they have a potency, right? But that energy, and that potency is a certain kind of energy that would produce a certain kind of result. But what that result's going to be, how it's going to work, has many, many factors. And I think it's because those are so, you know, maybe endless or countless, is why it's in that extremely hidden phenomena realm. So in that sense, we have to understand that things aren't predetermined. They're not fated to happen, and we can't control the results. But we can't control what kind of situations we put ourselves in. This is the thing that I think is hugely important. To me, Dharma practice would make no sense. It doesn't make any sense unless you understand this. Because if things were pre-fated, what's the point? You can't do anything. And yeah, we can't control those results. It is definite that that leads to that, but we can. We have a lot to do with the cooperative conditions. So for example, the kind of situations we put ourselves in encourage the ripening of our constructive or destructive actions. It's so important. It's a huge thing. Why is it that we're trying to... why is it that Buddhists care so much about the time of death? It's this exact thing. You're, by the state of your mind, by going through your day-to-day life, learning how to use the Dharma in your day-to-day life, working with these constructive and destructive actions and all that, abandoning things that need to be abandoned, adopting things that need to be adopted, we're training our minds. And then when the time of death comes, we can do exactly this to a certain level of degree, right? So in a more, you know, not talking about death, but just day-to-day life, we choose how much contact we have with certain things. We choose what kind of situations we put ourselves in. It's why we have precept. It's why we live in monasteries. So say, for example, if you're around people who don't have a lot of ethical grounding, aren't very responsible, and are reckless, they're setting the stage for our negative karma to ripen. And we all know Venerable's story about the time she was going to Koh Phan to meet up with a friend of hers that she had met at a course in California. And where is she? She had gone to a party in Thailand and ended up killed by a serial killer. You know, and she put herself in a situation that ended up, you know, she met a stranger, went out with lunch with him the next day, and that was the end. This is what this is talking about here. These were the environment that the person chose to put herself in, and this karma ripened, and she had a premature ending. So we also put ourselves in situations that are the kind of the stage for our positive karma to ripen. So again, it's not like set in stone. It doesn't necessarily mean that you go to a certain environment and this certain negative karma is going to ripen, or vice versa. It's not like that. It does mean is that these various conditions are at work. They're affecting what's going to ripen, how it's going to ripen, how big or small the results are going to be. It's more like that. So although we would say that you can't, as a Buddhist, we wouldn't say that things are fated or predetermined, we would say that you can't go beyond the scope of causality. So in that sense, what they're talking about there is that things aren't random. So for example, if you think about it, things aren't rigid and fixed, but they don't happen randomly or for no reason at all or just by chance. So even in science, we have that recognition that things happen, things have causes. So if you think about this in terms of karmic causality, then you could say that in our lives, what's happening to us, who we are, the situations we're born into, and what we experienced, they don't just come out of the blue. They don't just happen by chance. And this is what really is the topic of the results of karma. Explain what we're experiencing, where we're born, and all those things. If they did happen by chance, you could plant like daisy seeds and get petunias, right? Wouldn't matter. Just anything goes. So that's really not how it works. So that's trying to give a little bit of a overview. So does anyone have any questions first? I could go forward, but there's not much time left, so let's do questions if there are any.
Not that. So if you understand, if you get direct experience of emptiness that can purify karma to the point of removing it, but short of that, our purification of a negative action, it's still going to produce a negative result, just going to change the extreme.
Yeah, and I think it's to the point that that is quite workable, because you can actually, by, if you remember what the causes were for a precious human rebirth, a human rebirth is abandoning the 10 destructive actions. So by abandoning those and by purifying and by, you know, working to keep your mind in a virtuous state, even though you don't even have an inferential realization of emptiness, I think that you can at least die without regret. And you're putting yourself in a place to have a more opportunity for a human rebirth. And then for a precious human rebirth, there's more causes. Practicing the 6 perfections and also making dedications, proper dedications. So none of those are saying, you know, like at least the one for a human rebirth is not saying that you've realized emptiness. What you've done is you've abandoned these negativities.
So even if you've already committed some of the 10 destructive actions, like turning your mind to a state where you've abandoned them, that's the cause for the for a human rebirth.
Yeah, like think about Angulimali. I mean, he went beyond that. He murdered 999 people in one lifetime. In that lifetime, just like Milarepa, who murdered like 35 people by these hailstorms, he had maybe a better reason, but they were, his was more probably anger and retribution, and Gulamali's was ignorance was the motivating factor. Both of those were able, in that lifetime, Angulimali became an arhat. He realized emptiness, and Milarepa said became a Buddha in that lifetime. So not only were they able to, you know, clear enough away to have had a human rebirth or a precious human rebirth, they're actually able to, you know, clear the decks to have realizations and attainments in that lifetime. He still had to, Angulimali still had to deal with people knowing that he was a murderer, a mass murderer. And when he went on alms round, he got clobbered a lot and beat up a lot. And the Buddha said, Venerable told us, the Buddha said to him, bear it, you know. And he did. He has, you can see his cave. If you go to Shravasti in India, near there, not too far from there, there's the cave that he lived in that you can go see, actually. It's a real place. Somebody else had a question.
A number of questions.
Okay.
The first is, I thought that dedicated merit was protected, including from anger, but did I understand that it can actually still be weakened? And then someone adds to it, doesn't it have to be dedicated with bodhicitta and emptiness to protect the merit?
Yeah, this teaching here said it could be weakened. And I don't know the details. Basically, I think from a pragmatic standpoint, since I don't have bodhicitta or emptiness on board yet, the main thing that I take out of this is don't let your mind go to, when you do something virtuous, don't let your mind go back to a mind of miserliness and regret about having done something virtuous. You know what I mean? It's easy to do that. You know, your mind kind of flips and you're like, why did I do that? You know, and the same thing is like when something negative happens, like, you know, you read the newspaper and like what happened when they caught Bin Laden and all those people on these college campuses rejoice because, you know, it's like, that's really something not to do. Rejoice in somebody's being murdered or, you know, even though the whole situation is, you can, it's quite complex and understandable at some level. As a practitioner, you don't want to let your mind go there. I don't know, does anyone here know for sure the details on that dedications? It is good to dedicate your merit, and it has, I have heard that it protects it against anger later, but this teaching does say that that it can, and what I read in Lama Tsongkhapa made it, well, I guess it was Venerable's word that said it was dedicated, even ones that were dedicated. I'm not sure if I read that in Lama Tsongkhapa.
It doesn't say, it says it's destroyed by anger, it doesn't say unless it's dedicated.
Yeah.
It's
pretty clear.
Yeah, so anyway. Are there others?
Yeah, someone says, I react poorly in a given family situation and thought to avoid the situation, but then I thought to go and purify.
Mm.
Is it risky? I guess the person is asking for me to enter the situation.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Like, does everyone there know the question is online? Do I have to repeat it? Okay, good. And the people on the phone, the basic idea was, there comes a place where, you know, at some point, you want to avoid contact so that you don't get yourself in bad situations, say with a family where there's a difficult situation. And then there's another point where you might make a choice to enter into that situation. That really, I think, comes down to where you, what you feel that you're capable of. You know, if you're really not capable, like here's an example. If you went to your family's home and you felt like your practice wasn't strong enough to keep you out of trouble, instead meet with those people at a public restaurant where everyone controls their behavior better. And you still get to meet with the people, but you have conditions where everybody will keep within social norms a lot easier than they might in a private home. You know what I mean? You can kind of come up with creative ways to have a certain, because your practice maybe isn't like, you know, on board 100% of the time. That's pretty hard to ask in a lot of situations. So then when you can't do things fully, you have to avoid things. But you can't live your life avoiding everything. And that's what I find quite helpful in the practices that we have in our tradition in Tibetan Buddhism with the mind training practices. You can transform every situation that's adverse to benefit your Dharma practice. There's a way to turn every situation. So you have to fortify yourself. I know for myself, I was kind of in a situation like that, and I remember, I don't know when this was, it would have been around some time around 2000. I remember I wanted to have a very difficult conversation on the phone with someone in my family, and I didn't want to get angry, and I knew I couldn't control that too well, but I wanted to proceed. So what I did is I had a mala in one hand and a picture of His Holiness in front of me, and I made the phone call with a lot of determination to stay cool. You know, I mean, I had to set up these like little conditions for myself to, and it worked. It wasn't like the pictures made it happen. It was a lot of energy went into that.
I think what's helpful just to maybe clarify a little bit more is that the purification practice doesn't create a better circumstance. It's the thought training practices that actually change the mind. Because it sounded like, well, I'm going to do purification, now I can go into situations, it's all going to be different. That's how, what I heard. Maybe I misheard it.
Yeah,
she said something about
purification. It seemed like I will go into the situation
after
as
purify.
A form of purification.
Oh,
as a form of...
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you wouldn't, if the idea was that I will go into this situation as a form of purification, that's not really it. Because purification is applying the four opponent powers. That's what purification is. So putting yourself in harm's way is not purification. Putting yourself in difficult situations isn't necessarily that, you know. It's the four opponent powers.
Well, the purification has this sort of magic remedy that suddenly the whole dynamic in the family is
right.
All settled,
yeah.
Because you purified your part of it. I mean, it helps a lot, but I think there's a little more to it than just...
Yeah, I see what Venerable Simke is saying. Purification, I think, allows you to do the mind training.
Yeah.
in a sense, is one way I would put it, because it definitely, because you are doing mind training when you're doing purification, you are generating regret, not for other people's actions. We're not purifying other people's actions. We're purifying our actions. We're changing ourself, right? And so we're setting up this, you know, the regret in that is you're seeing the harm that you're doing and the mistakes you're making, and you're training your mind not to do those things again by having this regret. So, you know, it's a, it will change you over time.
But I do think, and it also depends, but I do think if you feel like you can go in to a situation where you habitually get angry and say, I'm going to go with an open heart, as your remedial action.
Yeah, that would work. Yeah, I agree with that. So she's saying if your remedial action was to go into it, that situation where you might have generate anger a lot of times, but I'm going to go in there with an open heart, I had that same thought. I agree with that. Your remedial action is whatever you decide it's going to be. You know, it's quite broad.
But if you're going into that situation thinking that the suffering will purify you, that just sounds like...
Yeah, that's wrong. Yeah. It's not the suffering of the situation that's going to purify you. That's the distinction that has, I think that we're fleshing out here.
It's the motivation.
Yeah, exactly. You can boil it down to a lot. Motivation is key for anything that we do. Right. But suffering itself doesn't purify you. The four opponent powers are what purification. Anything else?
Will you just repeat the list of the 10 wholesome actions in the Pali
tradition? Sure.
Oh,
the cause of, okay, yeah, sure. There's, okay, the... Okay, in the Pali tradition, they have these 10 constructive, wholesome actions, and they are, the first one is generosity. Ethical discipline is the second. Meditation. Humility and reverence. Reverence. The fifth one is offering service. The sixth one is dedicating merit. Rejoicing at virtue is the seventh one.
Rejoicing in virtue?
At virtue, yep. Rejoicing at virtue. Listening to Dharma teachings is the eighth one. Teaching the Dharma, and straightening out our views, or developing correct views. And then we have a little bit of time here, so I like this thing about the five types of causality, so you know, probably heard me talk about that a few times. I'm putting it in my words. In our Western words, they come from the Pali commentaries, and they the words are kind of different, quite different. But anyway, they boil down to, the first one is like physical causality. That would include things like atoms swirling around and tsunamis happening. They don't involve life, like physical chemistry doesn't involve life. So it's physical causality. The second one is biological causality. So now you have life, but you don't have mind on board. So Buddhists don't believe that plants have life, have a mind, but I guess the Jains do. So there's things, biological causality. And the third one is the citta, C-I-T-T-A, citta. Which is mind. You can think of it as like psychological. I think of it as psychological processes. It's described in things like when Bhikkhu Bodhi described it. It was like the processes that happen with perception and things like that, and seeing things. And I think I'm more a physio. I was a physiology major, so I think of it more in terms of like
psychology.
The psychological processes, you might say, There might, you know, like there's a lot of, we're wired in a lot of ways. Like when I saw a baby horse down the hill, I think the day it was born, and I heard this about some other kind of animal, the first steps it took, they were very patterned, like prancing, the kind of thing you teach horses to do, to prance, they lift up. And these are things that are mediated at your spinal cord, actually. In physiology, I've learned about these things. And I think that's what that horse did. It was, you know, and even babies have these things where you take a baby and you go, whoom, and they have this thing of reflex, the kind of reflexes where they'll put their legs out so they don't, you know, and there's all kinds of reflexes. You can go like this on a little baby and they'll turn the rooting reflex. So those are, I think of it in that level. These are things that are mind-related. They're processes. And then there's dhammic, the Pali dhammic, or we would say dharmic causa. Or no, the fourth one is karmic causality. There's an ethical dimension to our actions, our topic tonight. And then the fifth one is dhammic or dharmic causality. And that one is very interesting. Bhikkhu Bodhi said that the main places it comes up in the Pali Canon are most often are things like when you hear these things like someone becomes an arhat and the earth shakes, quakes, and trembles, those kind of scriptures. Or I think of it like when I went, the first time I saw His Holiness in Portland, there was like this big double rainbow when I came outside. To me, that kind of fit the description. But he also said, besides those kind of things, that he felt like there were passages in the Pali Canon that indicated more like our Dharma practice. Like, it's almost like we have the idea that we're creatures of habit, and if we do something habitually enough, we will be able to enact that in our lives, you know? We can get rid of our angry kind of reactivity and come up with loving kindness, you know, and those kind of things by practice. And yeah, there were references to things like that, the things that we practice become, you know, our dharma practice is what it boiled down to, and it related to things I think that were kind of habitual. I might have to pull out my notes, but that's the sense of my memory of it. Our dharma practice itself is a dhammic causality. Does that make sense?
In terms of these Pali 10 wholesome actions, do they also have restraining from the 10 non-virtues, and these are additional?
I didn't read anything else on those. You know, it was just something that I had. Although I have a feeling that in Venerable's book, they might be listed in there. I didn't look. We done? Okay, we're done.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So then the next couple of weeks we'll talk about body, speech, and mind. And I'll try to, because that gets kind of like a little too set to keep your attention, I'll try to intersperse things to... No, not, I don't know what yet. We'll find out. I'll stay tuned. Okay, so we should take a moment to dedicate our merit. So let's think about just how fantastic it is to have these kind of teachings. Maybe we could make the aspiration to read that book, the Sutra of the Foolish and the Wise, and not be the ones that are the fools. Lama or Geshe Sopa talks about that book. The reason it's called the Sutra of the Foolish and the Wise, because those who read it who don't believe these stories are the fools. There are all these stories about karma. They seem kind of far-fetched to a lot of us. But so may we, you know, develop a mind that where we can have this conviction in karma and take that into our daily lives and develop ourselves fully. And may this be for the benefit of others and their reduction and elimination of suffering and their peace.